The headlines this hour. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says that Tehran will avenge the recent assassination of a member of the group by the Zionists. Palestinian rights group says that last year's Israeli shelling of a warehouse in Gaza ignited hundreds of tons of chemicals in a northern town. Also in the headlines, the Russian foreign minister says that his country pursues what he calls the liberation of Ukraine's Donbass as an unconditional priority. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Bniz. Thanks for joining us. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says that Israel was behind the recent assassination of an IRGC colonel in Tehran. Major General Hossein Salami said that Iran's adversaries at the White House in Tel Aviv had been following Sayyad Khodai for months and years to kill him. Salami pledged to avenge the assassination of Khodai. The colonel was murdered in eastern Tehran on May 22. He was shot five times by two motorcyclists. A huge crowd attended his funeral procession on Tuesday. Based on U.S. media reports, Israel has informed U.S. officials that it was behind the killing. Israeli footsteps have already been traced to a number of attacks on Iranian nuclear sites and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Political commentator Mustafa Khoshesh explains why Iran has the right to avenge the assassination of the IRGC colonel.
Well, definitely this is going to be responded. Some people might think that how about previous operations? Iran has always vowed to take revenge. And they might have questions if this has happened ever. Well, Iran and Iranian officials, especially the top military, are not in the habit of acknowledging responsibility for operations. And when you hear the Israelis claim responsibility, it's not their officials, but it's their media in order to escape responsibility, because this is a clear case of assassination and terror, and it should be condemned. The Israelis should be condemned for that. And when the UN fails, other countries fail to condemn and punish Israel, then according to the international rules and regulations, Iran has every right to take retaliation.
Iran's president says years of U.S. and NATO military presence in Afghanistan brought the country nothing but devastation.
20 years of NATO and U.S. presence in Afghanistan has had no outcome other than war, bloodshed, and destruction. And the future of Afghanistan must be determined by the people of Afghanistan themselves.
Ibrahim Raisi says that foreigners do not care about the security of the people of Afghanistan and the region. He says the foreign military presence could bring regional security and won't do so in the future either. He made the comments in a joint presser with his Tajik counterpart, Imam Ali Rahman, who is on his first Iranian visit in 9 years. Rahman said that his country shares Iran's concerns about Afghanistan and backs diplomatic efforts for an inclusive Afghan government. He also called for access to southern Iranian port cities as a transportation link for his country. The two presidents oversaw the signing of 15 bilateral agreements, as well as memorandum of understanding, as part of what Rahman called a long-term roadmap for economic cooperation. The agreements cover energy, trade, transportation, and the tourism fields. The Palestinian rights group has accused Israel of war crimes over its shelling of a warehouse in Gaza during its attack on the Strip last year. A study by the group Al-Haq says the Israeli shelling ignited hundreds of tons of chemicals in the warehouse in the northern Gaza town of Beit Lahia, even though no fighting was going on nearby. Al-Haq calls the Israeli shelling chemical warfare by indirect means. The report quotes residents as saying that they suffered from diarrhea, vomiting, and intense stomach pains after the attack. Al-Haq says the attack deliberately targeted civilian, economic, and industrial infrastructure in Gaza. The Beit Lahia warehouse is the largest of its kind in the Gaza Strip. Al-Haq is the leading group providing information to the International Criminal Court at The Hague on alleged Israeli war crimes and crimes against humanity. Israeli settlers have held their so-called flag march in the occupied city of Al-Quds despite prior warnings by Palestinians who saw the parade as provocative. Thousands of Israeli settlers marched through Al-Quds and its old town while chanting anti-Arab and anti-Muslim slogans. Hamas, along with other notable Palestinian resistance groups, has issued warnings.
Dozens of Palestinians have been injured during clashes with Israeli forces and illegal settlers throughout the occupied West Bank, including East Al-Quds, where Israeli extremists staged a hugely controversial march. This year's march was reportedly partaken by around 25,000 settlers, who were being accompanied and protected by Israeli forces. The settlers were heard chanting Islamophobic and anti-Palestinian slogans such as "Death to Arabs" and "Shireen is dead," referring to veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aghla, who was assassinated by the Israeli military earlier this month. The Israeli settlers forced their way into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, performing religious rituals there. At the same time, Palestinians held counter-rallies across the occupied territories, waving Palestinian flag and chanting anti-Israeli slogans. In Ramallah, the protesters said, although the Al-Quds is occupied by Israel and surrounded by military checkpoints, it will always remain their eternal capital and the Al-Aqsa Mosque will always be a Muslim sacred site. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned that the so-called flag march in occupied East Al-Quds is a grave provocation against the Palestinian people and the Arab and Islamic nations, stating that the resistance will not hesitate to perform its duty of defending Palestinian sanctities and people. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates has condemned the Israeli settlers' latest raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Old City of Al-Quds, saying the Tel Aviv regime is fanning the flames of religious tensions by allowing such incursions into the holy site. Also, Iran has condemned the Israeli forces' desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque and their attacks on Palestinians there. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh warned against Tel Aviv's latest adventurism and provocative moves. He praised Palestinian people's resistance against the regime and recalled the Palestinian cause as the top priority of the Muslim world. He said all freedom-seeking people around the world, especially the people and governments of Muslim countries, have a duty to join hands to wholeheartedly defend Al-Quds and stand up to the apartheid Israeli regime. The spokesman also called on the international community and organizations to fulfill their legal responsibility by stopping Israeli atrocities against Palestinians.
The idea of a national Israeli day is a sign of a group of colonists living in the past. They think they are living a century ago. It is a disgrace in today's world, of course, where we are supposedly past the era of colonialism, rejecting the idea of apartheid. And the responsibility for this, of course, does lie on the colonists themselves, but it also lies on the sponsors of that colony. There would not be a apartheid colony in Palestine today were it not for the fact that many of the NATO states, in particular Britain, France and the USA, are the sponsors of this colonization, this apartheid. The situation would be resolved a long time ago if those NATO sponsors had not been supporting this regime for so long.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow pursues what he calls the liberation of Ukraine's Donbas as an unconditional priority. Lavrov says other Ukrainian territories should decide on their future on their own. His comments come after Russia intensified its shelling to seize Severodonetsk, which is the largest city under Ukrainian control in Donbas. Russian forces are now trying to encircle the key city. They also destroyed command posts and missile strikes on two towns near Severodonetsk on Sunday. The Russian military earlier said that they captured the nearby city of Lyman, although that account was challenged by Ukrainian officials. Russia is now focused on seizing the entire eastern Ukrainian regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Moscow says it wants to protect the local pro-Russia population there. Reports coming out of Ukraine's flashpoint eastern Donetsk region say that several civilians have been killed and over a dozen injured in the shelling of an area by Ukrainian forces. Local officials accuse Kyiv of using artillery and rockets with cluster munitions. Our correspondent, Johnny Miller, joined us earlier with the details.
I'm standing in the center of Donetsk right now, more particularly in front of what is or used to be a school. Now, this was hit earlier today. Two people were originally confirmed killed. That's been up to three people and five injured. Now, the shelling of the Ukrainian military on civilian areas of Donetsk is nothing new here. The first story I filed for Press TV when I arrived 2 weeks ago was exactly of that. It's a daily occurrence, and civilians are killed almost every day here. That usually happens in the outer districts next to the front line. What's new about this account, this attack? Indeed, there was one major attack just after the Russian invasion began of a Tochiku missile fired in, not far from here, which killed over 20 civilians. But usually Russian air defense is able to stop that. But what's new about this attack here is that it's in the center of town. It's a major strike, a much larger strike than you'd normally see in the outskirts, in districts like Petrovsky. Interestingly also, I asked people around here whether they think this school was targeted. They said, well, what do you think? Why? Because none of the other buildings are damaged. And this strike is right in the center, on the doorstep, if you like, of this building. It's a large building, a symmetrical building. The strike is right in the middle. There's also reports of another school nearby here, which I'll be investigating after this interview to see if that's been hit as well. Now, interestingly, I've spoken to the Donetsk People's Republic and asked them why now the Ukrainians are able to shell the center of Donetsk. They say it's because up till now they've only had artillery that can reach the districts next to the front line. But they are now blaming NATO and particularly the Americans because they think that it was an American heavy long-range artillery piece that's now able to reach the center of Donetsk.
An embargo on Russian oil over its war in Ukraine remains the main sticking point as EU leaders arrive in Brussels for a summit. Some leaders, including the European Commission president, says that the new anti-Russia measure lacks consensus.
We do have today one topic that is still open, that is the sixth sanctions package. We've been working very hard and successful with five sanction packages already. It's never been easy. It's the same now with the sixth package. The Commission and the French presidency have been working intensively in the last days to move forward on this package. We are not there yet, but it has matured for sure.
Talking to reporters upon her arrival, Estonian Prime Minister Kaja Kallas said it was more realistic to expect an agreement in the next summit. Remarks came as senior EU diplomats are still deadlocked. Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic have already expressed their opposition, arguing that an oil embargo would be a severe blow to their economies. However, a compromise plan has been discussed ahead of Monday's summit. According to a new draft, landlocked Central European countries would be given an exemption for pipeline deliveries of Russian gas. But the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said things are not looking good on any compromise plan for an oil embargo. Official data shows Germany's inflation has hit a fresh record as the war in Ukraine pushes already high energy and food prices up even further. The preliminary data from Federal Statistics Agency Destatis shows the country's annual inflation reached 7.9% in May. It marks the highest since German reunification in 1990. It is also the highest reading since 1973, when mineral oil prices increased following the oil crisis there. The Statistics Office attributes the current rise in inflation to energy prices. It says the war in Ukraine pushed energy prices to over 38% in May year on year. Food prices also increased by more than 11%. The office also blames supply chain problems due to the coronavirus pandemic as another factor pushing up inflation. Italy's two-time Prime Minister Romano Prodi has expressed serious concerns over the consequences that are associated with the Ukraine-Russia conflict. He has warned the sanctions against Moscow would cost a lot, mainly to Italy, Germany, and the EU.
On Friday, two-time Prime Minister of Italy and former President of the European Union, Romano Prodi, had his say on the Ukraine crisis and subsequent geopolitical developments during a meeting with journalists held at the International Press Association headquarters in Rome, known for having oversaw an extensive privatization of Italy's public assets and for his lack of ostentation. Prodi is today a retired politician. He expressed serious concerns at how the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will reverberate through the European Union, with the risk of creating divisions among the members of the bloc.
The Ukraine crisis fallout will hit the EU badly. Sanctions would cost a lot to Italy and Germany, less to other EU countries. Brussels has reacted unitedly to Russia, but peace must remain paramount.
Italy and Germany are the countries which have relied on Russian energy the most over the past 20 years. Rome has been trying to diversify its energy sources, but it will take at least 2-3 years before it achieves a total replacement of Russian gas. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Rome has been trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for over 40% of total gas imports. However, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, is that Italy's imports from Russia rose around 120% in value in April, while Italian exports to Russia showed an annual fall of almost 50% in the same period.
I have said many times that the impact of the sanctions against Russia will be completely asymmetrical. It goes without saying that the consequences on some countries like France or Spain will be milder.
Earlier this week, Moscow dismissed a plan for peace in Ukraine proposed by Italy. Also, Hungary has urged Brussels to call explicitly for a ceasefire in Ukraine. However, so far, some members of the bloc and the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have adopted a hawkish posture on Russia, never making any mention of peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The United States seems to be failing to protect its people by the week. With the gun massacre in East Buffalo, followed by the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, many Americans have spent the past few days gripped by overwhelming incredulity and grief, exhaustion and fury over the loss of life. But what can be done beyond living with heartbreak? The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and printed in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, U.S. Leaders Are Failing in Their Most Basic Duty. The United States seems to be failing to protect its people by the week, with the gun massacre in East Buffalo followed by the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Many Americans have spent the past few days gripped by overwhelming incredulity and grief, exhaustion and fury over the loss of life. But what can be done beyond living with heartbreak? There is incredulity at the inaction of the police in Uvalde, Texas. 78 minutes elapsed after the gunman walked inside before police, believing there were no kids at risk, finally confronted him, according to Stephen McGraw, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety. Meanwhile, 911 dispatchers received several calls from inside the classroom, including repeated calls from a child begging them to send in the police. By the end of his rampage, the gunman had killed 19 children and two teachers at the Robb Elementary School. Stephen McGraw acknowledged the multiple failures of judgment in response to a question about whether the commander at the scene should offer an apology to the victims' families. He said, "If I thought it would help, I would apologize." Police held back a group of horrified parents who gathered even as shots continued to ring out inside the school and begged police officers to move in and try to rescue their children. At least one mother was put in handcuffs only to spring over a fence and sprint into the school to scoop up her child when the opportunity presented itself. The police, she said, were doing nothing. Those officers had been training for years for just such an attack. Yet, when the moment came, all that preparation did nothing to stop a gunman wielding an assault rifle in a school full of children. There is unspeakable grief over the deaths of children like Layla Salazar, who liked to make TikTok videos, wear denim jackets and sing Sweet Child O' Mine on the way to school each morning. "They took her away from us," Layla's grandfather, Vincent Salazar, told the New York Times. "How do you mend a broken heart from a family as close as we had?" Irma Garcia, a teacher at the Robb Elementary School, liked classic rock. Her body was found with children still in her embrace, according to her nephew. A fourth grader who survived the attack said that Miss Garcia and another teacher, Eva Mireles, had saved his and other students' lives. "They were in front of my classmates to help," he said, "to save them." There is also a profound sense of national exhaustion that comes when tragedy is layered upon tragedy. In Buffalo, three funerals were held on Friday for victims of the mass shooting that took place at a supermarket on 14th of May. 10 people were killed in that attack and 3 others were wounded. "It's like Groundhog's Day. We've seen this over and over again," Mark Talley, the son of one of the victims, Geraldine Talley, said at a news conference on Thursday, 26th of May. In Buffalo, a white gunman targeted a predominantly black neighborhood with his AR-15-style assault rifle. He was an adherent of the racist conspiracy theory known as replacement theory, which posits that white Americans are being displaced by immigrants and people of color. Nearly half of the Republicans told pollsters recently that they agree with the general thesis that a cabal of powerful people is encouraging immigrants to come to the United States to sway politics. The combination of paranoia and firearms has led to tragedy again and again. "Why are we willing to live with this carnage?" President Biden asked the nation on Tuesday, 24th of May. The report of each gunshot in a mass killing echoes long after the next killing eclipses it. According to his family, Joe Garcia, Irma Garcia's husband, died on Thursday, 26th of May, of a heart attack. Mr. Garcia, a 50-year-old, had just gotten home from the memorial for his wife on Thursday morning when he collapsed. "It is entirely reasonable to ask how much more of this a nation can be expected to bear. The answer is infuriating. There have been 213 mass shootings in the United States in the first 21 weeks of 2022. An average of 321 Americans are shot every single day. And every day, there are roughly more than 50,000 gun sales recorded in the U.S. Properly maintained, those guns will fire like new for decades." There was some hope after a massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012, which left 20 children and 6 teachers dead, that America had finally reached the limit of tragedy it could withstand, and that perhaps the gun lobby had reached the high water mark of its power. A decade later, neither of those holds true. On Friday, the former president, Donald Trump, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota, and Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson of North Carolina all spoke at the annual convention of the National Rifles Association, NRA, in Houston, Texas, just a few hours' drive from Uvalde. There is no better manifestation of the gun lobby's total capture of so much of the Republican Party. States around the country have made halting but commendable progress in passing sensible gun safety measures, red flag laws, background checks, and age of purchase requirements. They face stiff headwinds. A federal court this month struck down a California law that set the age limit for purchasing semi-automatic weapons at 21. But the legislature is now considering other promising bills that would limit the advertising of certain guns to children and allow Californians to sue gun makers. Anything that introduces friction into the system of gun acquisition is to the good. In New York this week, a federal judge tossed out a challenge from gun groups to a law that allows civil lawsuits against companies that have endangered public safety. And New York Governor Kathy Hochul called on the legislature to raise the age limit to purchase some assault weapons to 21. The shooter in Texas waited until his 18th birthday to buy a pair of assault weapons and hundreds of rounds of ammunition. In Washington, D.C., there is talk that Republican and Democratic lawmakers might make a deal on some type of national red flag law, which would allow the police to take guns away from people judged to be an imminent danger either to themselves or to others. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, has been leading a bipartisan group of senators that is considering establishing a more comprehensive federal background check system, a reform supported by 88% of the American public. We have seen these bipartisan efforts on gun safety measures come and go without results. Still, in the face of Republican intransigence, Democrats, and President Biden in particular, should do whatever they can. Senator Chris Murphy, who has led the charge for tougher gun regulations since Sandy Hook, put it well on the floor of the Senate this past week. "What are we doing?" he asked his colleagues. "Why do you go through all the hassle of getting this job, of putting yourself in a position of authority?" he wondered. "If the answer is to do nothing, as the slaughter increases, as our kids run for their lives." It's a question that speaks to the Senate directly and the entire system of American government more broadly. Yes, the country's democratic system represents a diversity of views in the country on guns. But as currently structured, Congress is fundamentally unresponsive to the needs of its most vulnerable citizens, and has been corrupted by powerful interest groups, allowing those groups to block even modest changes to laws that the vast majority of Americans support. We, the American public, all share this vast country and need to figure out how to make it better and keep one another alive and thriving. Right now, we're falling at that primary responsibility. There are glimmers of hope, especially at the state level, that things are changing. But even there, progress is agonizingly slow and won't be enough for the hundreds of Americans who will be shot today and tomorrow and every day until action is taken.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Dr. Shum Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Tarbiyah is very important, not only topic, very important responsibility, and very humbling, actually, responsibility. It's very difficult task. I would like to share with you a beautiful hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam to make one point at least today. At least if I can explain this point, and inshallah it settles in our hearts, inshallah that would be a great achievement. So I am not giving you a full lecture on tarbiyah. I'm just trying to make at least one point clear. Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam is quoted as saying, "Ilzamu awladakum wa ahsinu adabahum fa inna awladakum hidyatun ilaykum." Ilzamu awladakum can mean look after your children. Can mean don't neglect your children. So for me, this sentence of Rasulullah is very, very important, amazing. Ilzamu awladakum. Especially as early as possible. Don't delay this. وَأَحْسِنُوا آدَابًا. Their education is important. Secular education, very important. Religious education, very important, necessary. But adab, I think, is more important. Because education is something formal. Adab is not formal. And it's very difficult. If you want to have children which are polite, which have good akhlaq in the social life, observe good etiquettes and manners, it's not easy. To send them for learning, you know, maths, chemistry, physics, it's easier. Even Islamic education, although it's not always easy, but still it's more manageable. But people have more difficulty when it comes to adab. And we have lots of emphasis about adab, to the extent that Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam says in Nahjul Balagha, "La miratha kal adab." You cannot inherit anything better than adab, or you cannot leave as your legacy like adab. Adab of this person with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, adab with his parents, with his brothers and sisters, with friends, with teacher, with neighbors, with khalqullah, adab with how to deal with animals, birds, etc., with, you know, environment. There are all different types of adab. Adab of studying, how to study, adab of sleeping, eating, drinking, all these adab. These are very important. And unfortunately, in more industrial and more modern societies, adab are very marginalized. There is not that much attention to adab. You want to eat, eat. You can eat any way you like. You can eat anything, you can eat anyway. And this even goes to many private things. You can do it anyway, anywhere. Just be careful not to get into some illegal activities. You want to come out nakedly. Yeah, maybe almost nakedly you can come out. You want to have sexual relation on the street. So unfortunately, adab, you want to talk your teacher, your supervisor, anyway. You can treat him like your friend, like your younger brother. Adab, unfortunately, are not that much emphasized on. The minimum we can say, they are not emphasized on in this modern life. And we have to preserve these adab. And my humble understanding is that actually adab are very, very important. And if we have adab, then inshallah other good things also would come. But if we don't have adab, suppose this person is full of knowledge. If you ask him any book on aqaid and akhlaq and fiqh, he can answer. But if he doesn't have adab, if he's not polite, doesn't have manners, I don't think this person is valuable and would cause more harm than benefit. So, إِلْزَمُوا أَوْلَادَكُمْ وَأَحْسَنُوا آدَابَهُمْ فَإِنَّ أَوْلَادَكُمْ هَدِيَّةٌ إِلَيْكُمْ. Your children are gifts given to you. You have to be grateful and you have to benefit from this gift and also preserve it and maintain it in a good condition. And if a gift becomes later something that would annoy me or other people, this is my misperformance. A gift should be always a gift. Not that a gift becomes later something that would annoy us or others. Okay, I stop here. I pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help all parents with their responsibility of tarbiyah of their children. And I pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bless all the children to have good manners, good etiquettes, and to know how to respect their parents and benefit from their parents and be prepared for their own, inshallah, turning future. If you are good children, inshallah, you would be also good parents, bi-iznillah.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As the Israeli regime continues to attack and harm Palestinians, European Union elites are publicly signaling their full support. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ali Abu Nima, writer. This article is published under the heading EU punishes Palestinian cancer patients to police Israeli regime. Here's the story. The European Union is making Palestinian cancer patients suffer as part of a campaign to appease the Israeli lobby in Brussels. It is doing so by withholding some $230 million in funding that was already committed to support Palestinians living under Israeli regime military occupation. The payment has been delayed since last year, as the European Union continues to condition the release of the money on specific changes to Palestinian school textbooks, the Norwegian Refugee Council stated recently. The aid suspension, reminiscent of the cuts imposed by U.S. President Donald Trump after he took office in 2017, is crippling critical sectors and services, including healthcare in occupied East Al-Quds, with dire consequences for patients needing treatment at hospitals, the charity added. These restrictions punish terminally ill patients who cannot get life-saving medicine and force children to go hungry when parents cannot afford to buy food, said Jan Egeland, the Norwegian Refugee Council's Secretary General, adding, Palestinians are paying the cruelest price for political decisions made in Brussels. As a result, at least 500 newly diagnosed cancer patients have been unable to access life-saving treatments at occupied East Al-Quds Augusta Victoria Hospital. Others are experiencing severe delays in receiving critical treatment. Those political decisions appear largely to be the result of a campaign waged by Olivier Varhelyi, a senior official in the European Commission, the EU's executive body. Varhelyi has been promoting Israeli lobby lies that Palestinian textbooks contain anti-Semitism and glorify terrorism. The lies about Palestinian textbooks are part of a long-running disinformation campaign by the Zionist regime and its lobby groups. The campaign aims to promote the ludicrous claim that Palestinians are hostile to Israel not because it has brutally violated their most fundamental rights for decades, but because they are being brainwashed to hate Jews in their classrooms. Although the campaign took off in the United States more than two decades ago, it has more recently been taken up by pro-Israel European far-right. Notably, Varhelyi was nominated to his post by Viktor Orban, Prime Minister of his native Hungary. Orban has circulated anti-Semitic tropes in election campaigns and conferred hero status on a Nazi collaborator. Yet, as the electronic Entefaza David Cronin has noted, Varhelyi has yet to denounce those manifestations of genuine anti-Jewish bigotry. Despite Varhelyi's claims being false, he is succeeding in what is perhaps one of his unstated goals, making the most vulnerable Palestinians suffer and maybe even die. A as the Zionist regime continues to attack and harm Palestinians, European Union elites are publicly signaling their full support. Earlier this week, Roberto Metsola, the president of the European Parliament, went on a high-profile junket to Israel, where she met the president, prime minister, and foreign minister. Metsola offered not a word of criticism for the Zionist regime's brutal rule over millions of Palestinians, which Palestinian, Zionist, and international human rights groups have characterized as apartheid, one of the most heinous crimes against humanity enumerated in the International Criminal Court's founding Rome Statute. Instead, Metsola addressed the Zionist regime's parliament, praising it as a house of democracy. Ignoring the Zionist regime's escalating crimes against the Palestinian people, including its recent killing and subsequent cover-up of Al Jazeera correspondent Shirin Abu Akleh, Metsola urged that the partnership between EU and Israel should be further strengthened. While pandering to the Zionist regime and complicity with its crimes is the norm for European Union leaders, Metsola's visit was even more than usually abject. She went ahead with it even after the Zionist regime denied entry to a delegation led by Manuel Pineda, one of her European Parliament colleagues. The mission was partly in response to the killing of Al Jazeera correspondent Shirin Abu Akleh. Pineda is the president of Parliament's delegation for EU-Palestine relations and thus plays an essential role in monitoring the use of European Union funding and the actions of the bloc's officials on the ground. Metsola did not show solidarity with her colleagues or demand that the Zionist regime respect the European Parliament by cancelling her visit. Instead, she issued a tweet expressing regret at Pineda's exclusion and claiming she would raise the issue directly with authorities concerned. The fabricated regime of Israel will almost certainly perceive these soft words, followed by Metsola's lavish and unconditional praise for the apartheid regime, as acquiescence and even a green light to continue excluding anyone it considers insufficiently subservient. It is unlikely coincidental that Pineda is currently the target of a character assassination campaign by the Israeli regime lobby. Recently, the Simon Wiesenthal Center published an open letter to Ursula von der Leyen, the unelected president of the European Commission, demanding that the popularly elected Pineda must be expelled from the European Parliament on the basis that he is a spokesman for terrorists. The Israeli regime lobby group laundry list of grievances against Pineda includes that he joined a 2011 flotilla to Gaza aiming to break Israeli regime's brutal blockade on the territory, and that he associates with members of Palestinian and Lebanese political groupings and resistance groups that the Zionist regime and its European allies have arbitrarily designated as terrorists. The anti-Palestinian group even repeats unsubstantiated smears that Pineda's left-wing party, Podemos, a member of Spain's governing coalition, was allegedly financed by some countries. These claims emerged in 2016, a part of what one Podemos voter termed a dirty campaign by Spain's then right-wing government. Yet they are exactly the kind of smears and the Zionist regimes and its lobby regularly use against anyone who dares to criticize them or stand with Palestinians. Leading Palestinian human rights organizations sent an open letter to European Parliament President Roberta Metsola. They denounced her decision to visit the occupied territories even after authorities there barred the delegation led by Pineda, with whom they were due to meet. They also condemned her offer of stronger ties with the Zionist regime, while failing even to mention the killing of Abu Akleh, as well as the Zionist regime's accelerating expulsions of Palestinian villagers in Masafer Yatta area of the West Bank. The groups told Metsola that you have failed to fulfill your responsibility under international law and make yourself complicit in the institutionalized domination and systematic oppression of the Palestinian people. Some of the groups that wrote to Metsola are among the six baselessly designated by the fabricated regime of Israel as terrorist organizations last year in an effort to stymie and discredit their work documenting its crimes. The EU, which has funded several of those groups, has allowed the fake regime of Israel to get away with the smearing. Now the EU is allowing the Zionist regime to do the same to its elected representatives. Brussels will do whatever it takes to serve and appease the fake regime of Israel and its lobby, even if that means deliberately and knowingly inflicting additional suffering on Palestinian cancer patients.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom has a long history among Muslim clerics. This is the speech of the leader of the Islamic Ummah on January 13, 2020, by Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with the officials of the Martyrs Who Were Clerics Commemoration Congress. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure progeny, commemorating the religious scholars and clerics who entered into the field of jihad and who ultimately achieved the blessing of martyrdom is a very good course of action. This is important because Muslim clerics have always invited people to do good. If those who are inviting to good take a leading role in doing good themselves, it will be more effective. Invite people to do good with means other than your tongues. Our martyrs, religious scholars, were individuals who invited people to do good both with their tongues and with their actions.
اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
During the sacred defense, I saw many young Muslim clerics who were wearing a military uniform and a turban on their heads. They were in the midst of the military troops explaining religious rules for the young people who were engaged in jihad and carrying out their duties as clerics. But they were not satisfied with just doing these things. I saw them from up close and knew them. They themselves stood in the front lines of the war, and a large number of them were martyred. Well, martyrdom is not a new phenomenon for Muslim clerics. In our books in the seminary, we have two books by two martyrs, the first martyr and the second martyr. The first martyr, or Shahid al-Awwal, Sheikh Shamsuddin Muhammad ibn Makki ibn Ahmad Amili Nabati Jazini. And the second martyr, الشهيد الثاني شيخ زين الدين ابن علي ابن أحمد عاملي جباعي. 2 or 3 years after beginning their studies, our students in the seminaries read the book, a commentary on Lum'a. Lum'a was written by the first martyr, and the commentary was written by the second martyr. They were two prominent martyrs and two stars in the world of Muslim clerics in terms of their scholarly status. Throughout the thousand-year history of Shia's jurisprudence, these personages were outstanding, both the first martyr and the second martyr. We have a third martyr as well, that is Muhammad Taqi Barghani.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.